Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, sometimes you ever drive by and see an old, rusty, broken down car, you know, and think, golly, that looks like the car I drove when I was a kid or that I loved, but there it is, it's falling apart, and you wonder what it would take to get that car back up and running and what it would cost to do so, and it takes you back into history. Well, if you're like that, you're going to love a new book by Earl Swift called Autobiography, and the subtitle is A Classic Car, an Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. This is a book that follows the 14 owners of a 1957 Chevrolet. Earl Swift, this is a fantastic book. Where did this book come from?
Well, thank you very much, D.G. It had its origins, really, I guess, in a series of just awful cars that I drove back in my 20s when I was in college and couldn't afford anything better. And, you know, most of them were falling apart when I bought them, and they were in far worse shape when I got rid of them. And I just encountered all sorts of expensive problems with them because, as you probably know, you learn a lot more about cars from driving a bad one than you do from driving a good one. And I'd often find myself, while dealing with their infirmities, wondering whether their previous owners had had the run of bad luck that I seem to be having with each of them. And that got me thinking about where these cars had been, what they'd seen before they came into my hands. And one thing led to another. And 20 years later, I was working for the Virginian Pilot, the newspaper in Norfolk. And I thought it might be fun to find one old car and attempt to trace it back through everyone who had owned it and tell a bigger story from that odd little fraternity of people who otherwise, I guessed, would be unconnected to each other.
It just started out as a newspaper article.
Well, it had its origins as a series of pilots that ran in December of 2004. And I found a car that I was able to do that with after several false starts. And at that point, the 57 Chevy station wagon in question had been owned by 11 people. So I was able to trace it through its first 11 owners.
Well, the story of how you were able to do that tracing is an interesting one that you have in your book. But I wonder if you just kind of give us a sketch of the history of either some of these 11 people that you found or the 13 that you ultimately had as you began to write the book, and then finally another person buys it. Who was the first person to own this car back in 1957, and why did he own it?
Well, this car was bought at Colonial Chevrolet in downtown Norfolk in late summer, early fall of 1957 by a guy named Nicholas Thornhill, who was a boilermaker, had been a railroad man in his past, and at this point was working for the Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Portsmouth, Virginia. And he bought it. He was mechanically inclined. He could keep a car running for a long time, and he had an old Chevrolet that he had kept limping along for years and was able to, and bought this car really because he was a gardener and he needed room for his soils and
it's a station. His car's a station wagon, so he could carry
it. Right. He was driving a sedan up until that point. And so he bought this car new. Paid $2,435 for it, not including its radio and heater, and drove it home. And he was atypical of car owners of the day who, usually kept their cars for 2 or 3 years and then traded them in. He hung on to this car for 15 years until his death in the early 70s, and then the car was passed along to his grandson, Bruce Thornhill Jr., who was a veterinarian in rural Chesapeake, Virginia. Bruce kept it for a couple of years and then sold it to one of his clients, a fellow who owned a poodle, which he took to Bruce's practice. That was Sid Pollard, who was a heating and air conditioning specialist, also from the Norfolk Naval Shipyard. Sid drove it for a long time, fixed it up, and drove it for 7 or 8 years. And eventually, when he had a baby, sold it to a friend of his who ran a body shop in Portsmouth. And that friend, in turn...
Well, that was Frank DeSimone.
DeSimone, yes.
We've got a great scientist at Chapel Hill named DeSimone. So that name, which is a rare name, binds the book to a very important person here in our lives in Chapel Hill, Joe DeSimone.
Well, I don't know if they're related, but
I tried to check it. There didn't. He came from Pennsylvania, but of course we're all related. If we take it back,
ultimately, isn't that true?
I couldn't. I wanted to make the tie, but I couldn't quite. Get them together.
Yeah, the Frank DeSimone owned it very briefly.
Why did he own it briefly?
Well, because he owned a body shop, and one of his panel beaters, one of his sheet metal men, had a buddy who would drop by the shop now and then, and who spotted the car and fell in love with it on site, and he and his wife then bought it from Frank.
What were the prices of this? It would started out at $2,500 or so. Mm-hmm. I guess the price is declining.
It declined precipitously. We're talking in the low hundreds at this point that the car was going for. I believe Frank sold it to Pikett Savage and his wife Debbie, this couple who had a friend working for Frank, for $500. And I think Frank had bought it for $300. So the car at this point was moved out to the rural edge of Western Tidewater to a neighborhood in Suffolk, where the Savages drove it, used it as a daily driver for Debbie's commute to her job at a big nursery in Portsmouth. And they held it for a couple of years, and then little things started going wrong with the car, as they always do. I mean, this is an old vehicle at this point. Its odometer had flipped into six figures. And so the Savages sold it to a co-worker of Debbie's named Mary Ricketts. Mary was a struggling single mother, had worked in the flower business for most of her adult life, a former rock and roll singer in a band.
Well, she had a story, didn't she? I
mean, she did. She was kind of a hippie chick and a very likable character, a free spirit who kind of embraced 1950s style long before it kind of circled back into fashion. And so she was wearing cat-eye glasses and wearing flamingo earrings long before they became kind of kitschy and fashionable. They were just odd at the time that she embraced them. And Mary owned the car for a long time. She owned it for close to 8 years and loved it. Probably of all the owners of the car, Mary had the strongest psychic bond with this piece of machinery, but she also was the least able financially to keep up with its mounting problems as it slowly fell into rust and ruin. Mary, much against her will, eventually sold it to a gay couple, Dr. Alan Wilson and his partner Al Seeley, who had joined an antique car club and very much wanted an antique car of their own, and bought this one with the intention of restoring it. Once they found out how much it was going to cost to restore it, and we're talking in the early 90s now, they abandoned the project altogether, and the car sat for a couple of years, exposed to the elements, nothing being done with it, really. From there, it eventually fell into the hands of a Norfolk pawn shop owned by a guy named Jack Reed. Jack's Classic Pawn. Stayed there just for a day or two. Reed really didn't even have time to clean it up before it was spotted by a Navy petty officer who was driving by on Tidewater Drive in Norfolk and pulled in and pretty much bought it on the spot. That was Jeff Simmons. And like other owners of the car, he had a grand vision of what it might look like fixed up. At this point, it was in pretty tough shape. It was running, but the front seats had collapsed to the point where you couldn't see over the dash, and the body was perforated by rust in a number of places. The paint had gone to hell. Jeff held it for a couple of years until the city announced that it was going to tow it away as a derelict vehicle if he didn't license it. And instead, he sold it to a guy named Dave Simon, who was a bit obsessed with Chevrolets of the 1957 model year, in that he had owned at that point, by his count, 284 of them.
Well, 284 57. Well, that we want to get back to that maybe, but keep going, and we'll before we take a break, get us to the, you're close to the end of the line now.
Well, we're getting there. Yeah, Dave Simon gave it to his son Chris as a high school graduation present. Chris also, like those before him, had grand visions for its restoration, lacked the financial wherewithal to make them come true. And so he, in 2000, 2004, early in the year, sold it to a born-again Christian garbage man in Chesapeake named Dave Marcinsuk. And Dave was mechanically able to do something about it. He got the car back on the road, used it as his daily driver, but eventually he sold it to a friend of his who restored old Chevys and was a hot rodder. That was Bobby Dowdy, who owned an electrical company in Virginia Beach. Dowdy kept it for a couple of years, maybe less than that, actually, and then sold it to a gentleman named Tommy Arnie.
All right, we're going to talk about this guy, and those of you who are with us, we've come to the sort of the end of the line, and Tommy Arnie, is that how you say it? Arnie?
Mm-hmm.
Turns out to be maybe the major character of this book. We're visiting with Earl Swift about his latest book, Autobiography. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Earl Swift, who is the author of a new book, Autobiography. The subtitle is A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. 57 years of history, coincidentally centered around a 57 Chevrolet. And you've taken us through the list of owners. We're going to come back to that last person. If you've already reached your driveway and you're listening to us and you've got to get out, just remember the name Tommy Arnie. He's the character that you will, I guess you could say, you'll fall in love with. You'll certainly come to admire, respect, and be. Earl, how do you describe Tommy Arnie? I can't find the word. Fascinating character.
He's a complex character, I guess you could say. He's self-made to a degree that most of us can't conceive of. He's a grade school dropout, made it to the fifth grade, didn't pass the fifth grade. He's a felon. He's been arrested 70 odd times. He was raised partially in the North Carolina orphanage system.
Was he born in North Carolina?
He was born in Lenoir. Yeah, uh-huh. He sure was.
And his mother lived up there.
Yeah, his mom's people come from an area called Meat Camp,
right? Yeah,
which is not far from Boone and in Blowing Rock. And he was born in Lenoir. Spent his first year and a half maybe in Lenoir, and then his family picked up and moved to Norfolk. His dad was in the Navy, Fred Arnie. So they wound up in Norfolk right at about the time that this car went on sale at Colonial Chevrolet a few blocks away.
So he's roughly...
At that point, Arnie's, Tommy's history and this car's history kind of weave, they braid together for the rest of the remainder of the story, pretty much. They had a number of close calls.
I want to come back to that, but could I get you first to sort of put in perspective, as you do in the book, the place of the 57 Chevy in American life and American dreams and in the economic, the sort of Eisenhower prosperity years of the 50s, the aspirations of American people.
The 57 Chevy now is visual shorthand for the entire era. But it was not that way when it came out. This was not an instant classic by any means. Ford outsold it that year, which is one of the very few times that had happened. It had not happened since the Depression when this car went on sale. And it wasn't until the 70s, really, that it emerged as the car from the 50s to own. And it you can catalog all of its individual charms, and there are many of them. I mean, it's got a lot of chrome. It's got a front end that has this huge pouting combination of bumper and grille that gives it a face, a very human kind of face. It's got bumper guards that jut from the grill like tusks at the corner of this very wide mouth, and it's got an amazing set of fins.
Fins is what, isn't that? That's what most of us would say. Hey, look at those fins.
If you had been buying a car in 1957, these fins would by no means have been the largest that you had to choose from. If anything built by Chrysler that year just had ridiculous fins. I mean, they look like something out of a space fantasy. But the 57 fins, just that they had a sublime scale to them. They, for one thing, they did not swoop upward like so many of the Chrysler fins did. They just ran straight back, and so they made the car longer rather than made the back end taller. And so the car has a very pleasing kind of length to it. It looks like a much longer car than it is because these things jut a full foot, you know, beyond the trunk or the hatchback. And this was a station wagon in 1957. A station wagon had a particularly important kind of place in among the American buying public, and that's because they advertised that you know, if you drove a station wagon, it wasn't like driving a frumpy grandpa mobile, as station wagons were later seen to suggest. You were driving a car that advertised that you had arrived at the suburban ideal. You were living the dream. You were out in the burbs, and that was a goal shared by a huge portion of the American public at the time.
Very
sexy.
American families at that stage as idealized on some of the popular television programs of the time.
Oh, you bet. You know, Leave It to Beaver, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. You know, any show that depicted families at the time, if they wanted to tap into the goals and dreams of the American public, they those stories were set in the burbs. And so this car was this was the SUV of its day. It was a status symbol.
At the same time as America is reflecting on this car and the cars and suburban life and the television programs that supposedly depicted what was going on in America, you then sketch the family life of your hero, Tommy Arney, running parallel, and his family life was not like Ozzie and Harriet's.
Well, tell us. You know, I think one thing that comes through pretty loud and clear is that nobody's life was like Ozzie and Harriet. I mean, the Thornhills, who owned the car at the time, were a pretty typical American family, but they, you know, it was not, their lives were not this pristine dream. You know, they dealt with the same challenges that people do in the course of a day, a month, a year, and
so the family lives of the owners often involved tension and often a little bit of marital bliss, but usually also arguments and stress,
sure.
And then oftentimes separation and divorce.
Well, yeah, we don't get out of this alive, and they had their share of heartache, and that goes for everybody in the story, and of course everybody in general. But that the lineup of owners of this particular car, I think, it's an interesting lineup because it's pretty typical. You know, there are very few characters of spectacular drama here, except for maybe Tommy Arney, because, you know, despite his very lean circumstances early in his life, he, through a combination of will and restless ambition, remade himself and became a tireless worker, gunning for that very kind of suburban ideal, that dream that the car represented when it was new.
Well, tell us about Tommy Arney. You started to tell us, and then I interrupted you about his growing up, both in as he went back and forth from North Carolina to Norfolk.
He wound up in the North Carolina orphanage system at the age of 13 and stayed in it until he was 16, and it was an unhappy time for Tommy, to say the least. He eventually ran away and hitched a bus ride into Norfolk in 1973 and kind of lived on the street for a while. Was eventually picked up for truancy and with the help of his brother wound up in the care of a bar owner in Norfolk, an old Irishman who took him under his wing and taught him the restaurant business, worked him like a dog, but also kept him out of trouble long enough for him to acquire a skill. And from that point on, Tommy bounced between living on his own and scraping by and spending time in jail. He spent quite a bit of time in jail. But he and his brothers eventually put together a chain of small businesses that morphed over the years into some pretty successful ventures. You know, by the time I met him in 1993, Tommy owned a lot of real estate in Norfolk. He was still a fifth grade dropout, remember? I mean, this is, you know, his origins had not changed any, but his circumstances had. He owned a go-go bar, actually several go-go bars in town, and he was making good money.
We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and learn some more about Tommy Arne, the I will call him the next to the last owner of the 57 Chevrolet, and a person of an incredibly interesting person. Visiting with Earl Swift, author of Autobiography. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Earl Swift. He's the author of Autobiography. The subtitle is A Classic Car, an Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. The Outlaw Motorhead, I think, is the guy we're talking about before the break. Isn't that right, Earl?
Tommy, no question.
What is an Outlaw Motorhead?
Well, he's certainly an outlaw, and he's a motorhead. I mean, he's a guy who... among his early businesses, his early business ventures with his brothers, was fixing cars and selling old cars. He owned a number of used car lots in Norfolk. And you know, one of the things I think that appealed to Tommy about auto repair was that there's no ambiguity about it. You know, if something's broken on a car, well, you fix it and it'll run. And up until that point, his life had been nothing but ambiguity. You know, there was no certainty that anything he did was going to end well. And I think he kind of found himself centered under the open hood of a car.
Well, for guys like that, even today, it's sort of like the old mule traders of old. You buy something cheap, you buy a mule cheap, you make him look better, fix him up, cure him if he's got an illness, and then you sell him for a healthy profit. And these guys who can work with cars, who have the ability to find people to work on cars, can buy it cheap and fix it up and make a, you know, not get rich, but make a little bit of money on each transaction. If you do enough of them, I guess you can make a lot of money.
That's true. And, you know, at one point he was buying cars from major dealerships. He'd buy the trade-ins and fix them up. And then sell them to independent car dealers, which line several big commercial streets in Norfolk and cater primarily to Navy enlisted. And, so it was a mule trading's a fine way to describe it. That's exactly the business that
they
ran.
Another business he was interested that he got involved in interested me maybe even a little bit more, and that he was in the club business or in the bar business or in the strip club business or the entertainment business.
Yeah, Tommy in the early 80s bought a go-go bar near Old Dominion University, renamed it the Body Shop, put a car on display inside, so it kind of combined both of his passions, and became an empresario of the go-go business, and at one point owned three or four clubs in Norfolk, catering mostly to Navy and to college undergrads, and was living the life. He enjoyed the go-go business a great deal. Eventually, had a cancer scare, got out of the go-go business, went into legitimate restauranting, and that's where he is really when the story begins.
Where was he when you first met him? I guess just to shorten the story, you met him first in circumstances that had nothing to do with this car.
Right. I met him in 1993 when I was a reporter for the Pilot and was sent over to the Body Shop because Tommy had successfully taken on the state to battle an arcane alcoholic beverage control regulation, which said that you could not serve hard liquor in the presence of a woman's exposed midriff or buttock. And both of those being central to Tommy's business model, he felt that he was being unfairly singled out by the state and took the state on to relax the rule and won. The state folded its hand, and Tommy was allowed to serve hard liquor. And so I went over to interview him about that battle and his victory. And this was 11 years before I got interested in putting together a newspaper story about an old car, and it was close to 20 years before I found out that Tommy had bought the car and decided to go ahead and try to write a book about it.
Well, when you first met him, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm going into this strip club where all kinds of bad things are happening, you know, exciting things for anybody who is interested in these things. And it must have, I mean, you're there theoretically to do a piece about the tax laws or the power of the state against American entrepreneur. But you must have gotten a little bit titillated and excited about the kind of life this guy was leading.
Well, I mean, Tommy...
surrounded by all these strippers
Tommy
and girls.
Tommy ran a very clean and as wholesome as such a place can be, wholesome club. It was a very well-managed place. There was no hint of danger or anything like that about the body shop. It was a place where clean, scrubbed kids from ODU hung out. You know, there was no biker bar. The greatest source of apprehension for me had nothing to do with the club and everything to do with Tommy, because he had a reputation, and I knew that going into the club in 1993. He had a few years before.
What do you mean he had a reputation? Was he a tough guy? Did he like to fight?
He had a tremendous reputation as a fighter, sure. And a few years before, he had become involved in a melee outside of a Norfolk Sailor Bar on Little Creek Road and had been interrupted in the middle of a fist fight by a Norfolk policeman with a canine with him, a German Shepherd. And what I had heard in 1993 going into the body shop, I'd heard several versions of the story, but what they all had in common was that the canine officer had released his dog on Tommy, and Tommy had grabbed it by the throat, choked it until it passed out, and then beaten the cop with his own German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I knew that this was a guy, you know, who operated by his own set of rules.
Well,
who, you know, was also a very formidable, physically formidable character.
Well, you got to know his son. And to tell us the story of how you're teaching, I mean,
sure.
This is you're teaching writing, you've done the story about Tommy Arnie, and you've done the story about the cars, and you're through with all of this.
Well, I was through in so far that in 2004 the series appeared in the paper. And I toyed with the idea of trying to turn the story into a book. And what I found was that the first 11 owners, interesting all of them in their own right, lacked a single dominant character who could drive a narrative of, you know, 100,000 words.
You couldn't string the individual stories together on a string held together by the car, you felt. I mean, you did
no,
it in the
what
series.
What I wound up with was a necklace of 11 separate stories, not really bound by a single narrative thrust. There was no forward propulsion. They were interesting vignettes, but they did not have a unifying, forward-moving, you know, character to really take you through the story and to make you care about one car. So I set the idea aside and had no expectation that I'd return to it. But it never really left my wish list. I mean, I thought it would be a great idea for a story if someday the story presented that main character. So in 2007, I think it was, I had a buddy who taught a writing class at Old Dominion University, and he got called out of town, and he asked me to take his class for a night. So the subject I was to speak on was chasing paper, using documentary evidence in writing feature stories. How do you use, documents, government documents, old records, yearbooks, whatever, to help bolster the factual underpinnings of a story that really doesn't show its bones, you know, a feature story. I carried along with me as an example of some of the tools that you can use, a city directory, which I'm sure your older listeners will know is a, it's like a phone book, only it's, in addition to having everyone listed alphabetically, it tells you a little bit about what they do for a living, tells you how long they've lived in their house, whether they own or rent, and it's cross-referenced so that you can look them up by address as well as by name. And you can also look them up by phone number. You know, all the phone number prefixes mm-hmm. are listed, and you can go down the prefix, jump over to the four last numbers and find out who has that phone. And back in the pre-Google days, it was, they were very important tools used by salesmen and other businesses in making calls. And anyway, so I had used a city directory to close an ownership gap between the 8th and 10th owners of the car. And I was telling the students how I had done this. And after the class, this young man walks up, skinny, a couple days growth of beard, and says, you know that, and I described the car in some detail in my lecture. He said, you know that car you were talking about? And I said, yes. And he goes, well, my dad owns it. And I said, really? He does? And he goes, yeah, and he knows you. I said, he does? Who is he? And he, Ryan Arnie, then said, my dad's Tommy Arnie.
Oh, my golly.
And instantly I realized that I now had a main character.
So you didn't know that Tommy Arnie had bought the car until that moment?
Right. I had no idea.
But now, Tommy Arnie, he's the guy who knows the value of a story. He knew that you'd written about this car.
He did. He bought the car knowing that that was part of the sales pitch for his purchase of the car, was that it had a complete provenance. And it had a complete provenance because I had done the trace for the newspaper story. Well, so it all became, the snake swallowed its tail at that point.
It did for me at that point, because I realized that forgive me for using the term, but I mean, here's a piece of junk, really. I mean, this car is worn out. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It will cost much more to restore it than it would to buy, a brand new car. But the story attached to the metal makes it for sale in America, where we love stories. It increases, you had increased the value of that piece of junk by your series.
And for Tommy Arnie, I certainly did. I'm not sure if that would have been the case with all buyers, but
no, but not with all, but with some of us who say, I can even say, I would like to own that piece of junk because I could tell my friends, here's the story of this car.
Yeah, yeah, and really, it becomes, the story of America, because it's seen such a variety of owners in its past. And car guys also know how unusual it is to have a provenance like this. I mean, there are a lot of cars out there that are recognized as keepers from the moment they leave the showroom, and they only are held over the course of, say, 57 years by a couple of people. Or cars that acquire kind of classic status very quickly and fall into the hands of collectors. And provenance for those cars is no problem to establish. And usually it involves a very short list of owners. But it's another thing entirely to try to trace back your average, kind of typical, yeah, nothing special about it, middle-of-the-line vehicle like this one was. This is not a Bel Air. It was a 210 model, which was the kind of the middle of the three trim levels that Chevy offered in 1957.
Let's take a quick break. I'm visiting with Earl Swith, author of Autobiography, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm visiting with Earl Swith, the author of Autobiography. And Earl, when we stopped, we were talking about one of the owners of these, but you mentioned that tracing ownership is not like what I did when I was a lawyer searching the title to a house. There's more to it.
Well, more or less, I'm not sure which, DG, but the problem with establishing ownership or establishing provenance is that there are no records to draw from, because DMVs around the country typically shred their records after a couple of title transfers or a few years. And so you're left having to find an owner who remembers enough about the person he or she bought it from that you can figure out who the seller would have been, and go to that person and repeat the process over and over and over again back to the car's origins. And Needless to say, that involves luck as well as detective work, and I had to rely on both in pretty equal measure, really, in completing the trace on this car.
Mm. Well, what this final or the final owner, the guy we've been talking about a lot, this very interesting businessman up in Norfolk, decided he would buy the car and restore it. How did that go?
Well, it you know, he runs a business that folks headed to the Outer Banks may be familiar with. It was called Moyock Muscle, and it was on Route 168 in Moyock, a big 5-acre lot just filled with hundreds of old cars. And he set his expert body man and paint man, a guy named Paul Kitchens, on the task of trying to bring this car back to life. And the last several chapters of the book relate how Paul battled a very tight budget and pretty primitive working conditions to just achieve a near miracle. And, you know, all of this is happening as well while Tommy, his boss, is wrestling with a number of pretty serious distractions, including the collapse of his business empire and his real estate holdings and the attentions of the federal government, namely the FBI, into his affairs. So the whole thing comes to a bit of a crescendo where, you know, in the closing days of his attempt to save this car, he's also having to attempt to save himself.
Well, did the car ever get restored?
We're just going to leave that unsaid.
Do I have to read the book? Well,
got to do it.
Well, I've read the book, and I still don't know for sure.
Well, you and I could talk after the show about that.
Well, tell us what you will about Tommy Ernie and what's happened to him. I think it's pretty clear from the promotional material in the book that he did have to go to jail, and is he doing okay?
Well, of course he's no stranger to jail. So, but Tommy's distractions mount in number and severity until they prove somewhat overwhelming. But I really don't want to go into too much detail because it really is, it's a spoiler, you know.
And, well, let's don't do that. And is there since there's more happening, is there a sequel for this book, either in terms of a long article or a new book that would follow Tommy or follow you or follow the American dream in the car?
I know Tommy has talked about writing his own story, and so I wouldn't be surprised, given his will, I wouldn't be surprised to see him do that. If I were to revisit the story, I don't think it would be in book form. I think I've said all I have to say about this particular car and about cars in general. I'm not an automotive writer. I'm pretty much a general assignment sort of journalist. It just happened to hit on an inanimate character in this story that served as the brick, the mortar between the bricks of a much more interesting human story, I think.
Well, it's a great story. You got time maybe for one more question that interested me, and that is that you delve deeply into the lives not only of Tommy but of several of the other owners, and the stories were poignant, but not always beautiful in terms of what was happening in these families. And did you get kickback from them about how deeply you went into their personal lives? Did they like being featured in articles and in the book, or did they resent that you?
I've detected no resentment at all. In fact, it's interesting. I think that they are all tickled that the car still exists.
Wow.
All of them regret having sold it. I mean, this is a car that really meant a lot to each of them.
What a great story about a great car. Each of the separate stories for me was fascinating, and the way you brought together this incredibly legendary figure as a part of it, that was just icing on the cake. Thank you so much, Earl Swift, for this great book.
DG, thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks to you, all of you, for listening. This is DG Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.